Professor Ron Robin, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're president of the University of Haifa. First of all, what brings you to Sweden right now?
We're a small university. We're one of the smaller universities. There are basically 8 universities in Israel. And I have ambitions, imperialistic ambitions. And one of them is to have a international footprint. And I have used the good offices of a friend of mine, Professor Beltin Anderson, who was president once of Yonsoping University, then afterwards of NTU in Singapore, a well-known figure on the Nobel Prize Committee for Chemistry. And we came here together. We gave him an honorary doctorate in Linköping. And we have been moving around the country, meeting various university rectors and department heads, and we intend to have a Swedish footprint or a Swedish alliance with a number of institutions over here. You may know, in the landscape of Israeli universities, we are somewhat unique.
Yeah, you have to explain to our listeners in what sense you are unique.
Yeah, we're in the north of the country, in the city of Haifa, which sits on Mount Carmel, the biblical Mount Carmel.
Yeah.
Spectacular location. It is also a place where Jews and Arabs have lived together peacefully for years. When you think of the Middle East, you usually hear of strife, obviously. That catches headlines. But there are places, and Haifa being first and foremost, with a very highly educated population, where Jews and Arabs have collaborated, cohabitated, worked together, lived together, and it's reflected in the university. 40% of our students, I will call them minority students. That means they're either Muslim, Christians, or Druze. That's 40% of our undergraduates, 30% of our graduate students, and that's very dramatic. So we see ourselves as a university creating a new Israeli middle class,
okay,
which is inclusive of everybody, embracive of other cultures, and coming up with what I think Israeli society might look like 10 years down the road. Maybe I'm being optimistic, and it's 15 years down the road. Because middle class values, I'll call that for shorthand, represent a bridge between cultures. We live in a part of the world where crisis is part of our daily life. And in order to bridge those crises and to continue having a normal life, we have to embrace common values. And those common values, for lack of a better word, I'll call them Western middle class values. It's a belief in a meritocracy, in egalitarian society, and in basic fairness, and of course the democracy, which, as you know, in Israel right now is a very significant debate.
Yeah, I want to really come back to that. But first, would you also call these values secular values?
Oh, absolutely. Although it does not mean you can't embrace religious values at the same time. I've been exposed to the Swedish church over the last 10 days I've been here. And I've never seen such a secular church in my life. Now, I don't aspire, I don't think that's ever going to happen in the Middle East. But I've traveled a lot, and I don't think there's there may be at an intellectual level an inherent clash between religious values and secular values. But people have a way of working those things out. And so while I think the overriding values are secular, it does not necessarily preclude the fact that people are believers of one kind or another.
No.
And I can see this in Haifa, it works very well. I myself am an agnostic, but I'm surrounded by people who have very strong views about the Almighty. And we get along, we work, and we figure things out. So yeah, it is basically secular, but it's not exclusively secular.
No, I understand. It's interesting, you define yourself as an agnostic. Was that a part of your upbringing, or is that a conclusion you sort of have drawn later in life?
So I'm the proverbial wandering Jew. I was born in Israel to a South African father who came during the war in 1948 as a volunteer. And my mother comes from an old Jerusalem family, 5-6 generations Jerusalem, originally Turkish, but she grew up and went to an English-speaking school in Jerusalem. At the age of 6 weeks, my family moved to South Africa. where I grew up, returning to Israel at the age of 14.
Where in South Africa did you?
In Johannesburg.
Ah.
And a very typical sort of Zionist family, liberal Zionist family. My family left, almost all my family, 14 cousins, uncles, aunts, left South Africa. 1961, it was after the Sharpeville incidents. If you may recall,
There
was a defining event in South Africa in 1961, more or less, when police fired on black demonstrators, and then I would say about half the Jewish community in South Africa left.
Mm-hmm.
Some went to Australia, some went to the UK. The majority came to Israel, and these were people who were definitely liberals. And
anti-apartheid.
Decided that enough was enough and left at that particular time. And I've lived everywhere since. I've lived all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
I've lived in the States for many, many years. I'm educated in the States as well.
Yeah.
I've lived in Italy. I've lived in many, many places.
But I can hear a little South African accent.
Yes, buried somewhere over there.
Yeah.
There's a South African accent.
I've been to Cape Town quite a few times, and I love the country.
Yeah. And so I'm very much a Jew culturally. Mm. I celebrate all the holidays.
Mm.
But I'm a secular Jew.
Yeah.
And
your family was a secular
family. They were sort of like traditional,
mm.
but mildly traditional. I grew up in such a household, and I'm deeply Jewish, perhaps more than Israeli. I'm deeply Jewish, but in a very secular manner.
Mm.
The traditions are meaningful for me, continuing a semblance of Jewish culture, which is this incredible fusion. Being something very ancient and something very modern, I find extremely attractive. But I'm sort of a rootless person, as many Jews are.
Yeah. And you were connected to the New York University for a few
years? I left Haifa after being there 20 years, around 2005, and I moved to NYU. I was a professor of history and communication. But after a while, I went to the president and I told him I was bored stiff and I wanted an administrative position, and I got one. And I was senior vice provost. I was in charge of building NYU's spectacular campus in Abu Dhabi, and then afterwards building a campus in Shanghai.
Wow.
I would have probably stayed in New York, maybe, but we have 4 children and we have 7 grandchildren. And they all live in Israel, and it became a little weird to live in New York when the whole family resided in Israel. And then an opportunity came to go back to my university as president, and I've actually never looked back. I feel that this part of my career as in a public university, serving a cause that is allowing people on the margins of society to enter the middle class, is a vocation which I gladly embrace.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy with it.
I see. The University of Haifa, what kind of topics can the students study there?
Yeah. So the majority of our students look for professions, and I think that's part of the world today. So the School of Public Health, or the School of Health in general, we provide all health professions with the exception of training doctors. That's done in a nearby university, in the Technion.
Mm-hmm.
Is a school which attracts many, many students. Law attracts students.
Mm-hmm.
But we're basically a university, not unlike the university here in Stockholm, University of Stockholm. We're basically a university of social science and humanities. We have strong life sciences as well.
Uh-huh.
And our strongest field is marine sciences. We're close to the sea. Mm. We're the only university in the country that does marine sciences. We have equipment that goes to the bottom of the sea, albeit the Mediterranean is not that deep. Mm. It's not the Baltic. But that's our claim to fame. Anything that has to do with the sea is related to Haifa in one form or another.
And how many students are there?
We're close to 18,000 students.
Wow.
Of that, about 15,000 are degree students.
Yeah.
And others take micro degrees or, you know, other sort of things.
Mm.
We are predominantly oriented towards women. This is very interesting. Even our minority students are predominantly women. This is, as somebody who sees himself as a social historian, this is something extremely important, because women are the agents of change in families. And so if the majority of our minority students, for example, are women, and they are, this means that change will be rapid in minority society. And it is. I can give two very swift examples.
Yes, please.
The rise in marriage age has been dramatic. Uh-huh. From the late teens to the early 20s, it's now the late 20s.
Wow. In how many years has that changed?
10 years.
Wow, that's a big
change. And the number
change.
Of children, which used to be very large, has dropped to Jewish levels now. Mm-hmm. So that gives you a sense. It hasn't passed without crisis in society, in Arab society. Mm-hmm. But it gives you a sense of how dramatic the change is.
What kind of crisis did it cause?
These are traditional societies where the role, patriarchal societies, yeah, where the role of the husband, the father, has for generations been quite stable, and this is changing. Mm. In many cases, women earn more than men. They definitely are more educated, and this is a source of crisis. By the way, the university is a source of crisis. It's the first time ever that young women and men from Arab society meet without the supervising eyes of village or family or clan. Mm. And you can imagine this is not an easy transition, but it's a very significant one. I'll give you an example, if I may.
Sure.
When we returned to Haifa 10 years ago, we lived on Mount Carmel. And it was the time of the high holidays, the Jewish holidays. Mm. Now, this is something that your listeners might not know. Yom Kippur, which is a very solemn day in a secular city like Tel Aviv or Haifa, is almost carnivalesque because the stores are closed, there are no cars on the road, but people don't go to synagogue to pray, and they're with their bikes and prams and skates on the streets, and it's very, it's almost a happy event, strangely enough.
Yeah.
And I'm used to this, and we walked out on the street, this happened 6.5 years ago, and it kind of looked the same as it looked before we had left for the United States. But it wasn't. It was the amount of Arabic on the street, spoken Arabic, that really struck me. So Haifa has always been a very stratified city. But originally it was stratified Arabs at the bottom of the mountain, Jews on the top. Mm-hmm. It's now stratified socioeconomically. Mm-hmm. So Arabs who have entered the middle class live on top of the mountain. Mm-hmm. And this has happened because of universities, nothing else. Wow. And this is a dramatic change in Israeli society. And what I tell people all the time, don't be distracted by current events. Think long term. What the society may look like given current developments, which are slow, they don't happen overnight. But if you look carefully in cities like Haifa, you can see they're very dramatic. Yeah. And for example, the number of Arab students in all the universities is growing. In Haifa, it's overwhelming, but in all the universities, it's growing. And this is going to have a profound effect on Israeli society in the future.
So, yes, that sounds very reasonable. But could you explain to our listeners what is happening in Israel right now? Because we follow it, of course, through Swedish media. And I'm not sure that the Swedish media reports on this in a correct way, so to speak. I mean, could you explain from your point of view what's happening, the dramatic political development in Israel right now?
Yeah, it surely is dramatic. It's a form of debate over the future of society and the nature of democracy. And it's been quite dramatic because it's the level of public participation which I think makes it very dramatic.
Yeah.
So this crisis at the beginning seemed to engage people like myself, you know, people who are 60, 70, come from the large cities, urbane intellectuals, but very swiftly it became a mass movement.
Yeah.
And when we look at demonstrations, which by the way, we're in the 16th week of demonstrations that take place, 16 weeks. Mm. The last demonstration, which was very typical, the largest one was in Tel Aviv, for obvious reasons. There were 120,000 people on the street.
That's a
lot.
In
Haifa, there were 35, 40,000 people. Mm. Haifa's a tiny city, by the way. Mm. And it engages many people, and it's about It's been very interesting what it's done for the vast majority of educated people who are liberal and lean slightly towards the left, or maybe more towards the left. It has created what I'll call a vital center. You perhaps remember Freud in one of his discourses spoke about the narcissism of small differences, how people are sort of divided by almost petty differences. Mm. They may be political, they may be social. This has been erased, effaced, and there is now what I would call a huge group identifying with the center. They may lean slightly to the right, they may lean slightly to the left, but put aside their differences and are fighting for what is the fundamental core of any democratic society, and that's checks and balances and the separation of powers. Mm. Our founding fathers and mothers did not think very carefully about the nature of democracy and did not create many of the checks and balances that you would find in any society. If we take Swedish society, for example, you have regional councils and you have regional government, and you have all sorts of ways of ascertaining that no one party can impose its views without taking into consideration the sort of rainbow of opportunities that exist in society. In Israel, there's no separation of power. That's the way the system, there's first of all no regional elections to begin with. Mm-hmm. There's no upper house. I don't think there's an upper house in Sweden either, right? Mm. Yeah. The parliament is just an arm of the government. And so there's really nothing standing between capricious moves on the part of any government, not necessarily the present one, and society. The only body that stands between us is the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has been judicious and adamant and militant in making sure that we maintain the fundamental aspects of a democracy. Politicians are short-sighted people, anyone. That's the nature of politics.
Yeah.
And everybody wants to get their agenda inserted into society, even at the cost of creating an imbalance. And of course, the Supreme Court has been very central in this. And what is happening right now is an attempt to, it's regime change, is an attempt to create regime change by weakening the Supreme Court and by giving government a greater say in appointing judges to the Supreme Court and judges in general, which in a society with so few checks and balances would be devastating to the nature of democracy.
And why does the government want to do that, in your opinion?
They're frustrated. Mm-hmm. So this particular government has an agenda, a very clear agenda, which you can accept or not accept. That's not, I care not to comment on that really, but I've been frustrated time and time again by the Supreme Court, which treats a certain number of laws as foundational laws. We don't have a constitution.
No.
But we have laws which are called foundational laws. Mm-hmm.
And
they are currently more difficult to change. Mm. Part of the agenda of the current government is to facilitate change to foundational laws. Mm-hmm. There are 120 members of Knesset. If the current government has its way, 61 members will be able to change a foundational law, which makes it meaningless. It's not a foundational law anymore.
No.
To have more judges who are, more attentive to the current political climate, to change the nature of foundational laws, and in order to assert a certain policy, which I care not I'd rather not comment on it.
Okay.
I'd rather comment on the significance of this change. Mm. And this is what the fight is all about. And it's caused a joining of forces in the center, which is quite spectacular, and I must say, I must tell you a story. Recently, we offered an honorary doctorate to Marina Abramović. You may know her. She's a famous performance artist. And she is originally from Serbia.
Mm, yes.
And I was trying to explain to her what's happening in Israel, and she asked me a question which caused me to laugh and then reflect. She said, but I don't understand. Tell me who does the military support and who does the police support? And I said to him, Marina, that is such an Eastern European question. Why would you ask me a question like this? These people are civil servants. But when I left and I pondered upon this question, it is a very significant question. And indeed, these are civil servants, and they abide by the law. And I think they've made it very clear, they, meaning the leadership of both these organizations, that the interpretation of the law will be done by the courts. And if there's ever a conflict between the courts and government, they will abide by the courts. Mm. This is very significant. Mm. And so Marina Abramovich's question was not necessarily out of line. It's a significant question, which I never thought about before. Mm-hmm. The notion of civil servants is still very strong in Israeli society. Mm. And they will abide by the courts, I'm pretty sure about that.
This is really fascinating to hear. Well, I mean, this massive engagement from the people demonstrating now, do you think the government cares about that, or do they just go on with their ideas?
No, they very much care about it. The demonstrations are massive, as you suggested. They put a lot of pressure on government. You know from your own newspapers and your own media that this films really well, large demonstrations, and so everybody knows about this.
Yes.
And so the government is under tremendous pressure. Mm. Should they move forward with this, irrespective of public resistance, there will be a constitutional crisis in the country. And I hesitate to think where that will lead us, but I think they've pulled back, realizing that this is something that will not go over well internationally and definitely will affect the Israeli economy detrimentally. The Israeli economy is thriving. Mm. It's based on, as you know, mostly on high tech and innovation. Mm. And there is already a movement of money outside of from Israel to other parts of the world. Uh-huh. And it will, rating agencies have already paid attention to this. It will have a tremendous effect on the economy. It will have a tremendous effect on reserve duty as well. As you may have been following this, many people from the Air Force, for example, have said that they will refuse to do reserve duty in the military if this happens, and that's very significant. There's nothing that can be ignored about what's happening right now. Absolutely not.
Interesting. Very, very interesting and very dramatic. Tell me, I know that your work on communication and media and history, your knowledge about that, what does it tell you about the effect of the new media technologies in crises like this? I mean, is it good or is it bad that we have new communication tools in this situation?
Yeah, so it's both good and bad.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Of course. So I'll give a couple of examples.
Yes.
On the one hand, it has been amazing in getting people to work together. It's like the internet. I'm not quite sure who's in charge of this movement. But there are websites and there are Telegram and WhatsApp, and people get together and coordinate activities. Just one example, when the Prime Minister threatened to depose the Minister of Defense after he had spoken out of line, it took an hour before the streets of Tel Aviv were full with over 100,000 people. Mm. And that's due to communication through new media. On the other hand, new media, and this is not an Israeli issue whatsoever, has disrupted national narratives. Mm. It has privatized national narratives. It's allowed different groups to create narratives of their own, to coalesce groups of people around these narratives, and has disrupted what was always a fragile national narrative. Mm. And in that sense, has added fuel to the flames of the various opposing parties in the current debate in Israel. Mm-hmm. And it's allowed all sorts of aspects which we thought were dormant to spring up to life. We thought we'd perhaps reached a modus vivendi between ultra-Orthodox and the less religious Jews in the country, or the secular Jews in the country, between the great divide of Sephardim and Ashkenazim. Mm-hmm. And what new media has allowed is given magnetic personalities or charismatic personalities the tools to
polarize.
Rekindle and polarize, exactly.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, and that happens all over the world of course. Different contexts right now. Yeah. This is really interesting. I mean, I know that you have been involved in a project on artificial intelligence as well, right?
Yeah.
I read somewhere. Do you think that the new large language models and this new sort of AIs producing content, will that create even more polarization than we have now? Is it dangerous, do you think, what's going on now in AI?
So I can just comment as a layperson. I definitely don't have the technical skills to comment on it. I don't believe, and I'll try and explain why, I don't believe that artificial intelligence can actually emulate human intelligence, because human intelligence is an interaction between mind and body. And we get feedback from our body, and our it works in both directions,
yeah,
of course.
True.
And so if you disengage the mind from the body, that's not human intelligence. That's something else altogether. Yeah. You can emulate, you can make a picture. I'm looking on the wall here at various pictures. I could probably manipulate these pictures to look like something else. And one could produce a text that looks like it was written by a human being. But large-scale developments depend on humanity, and humanity is fundamentally an interaction between body and soul. It's mind and body, and I don't. So what is artificial intelligence? It's a collection of infinite information, and some sort of use of that information in order to provide. A path of some kind, or a letter of some kind, or I'm sure you can write a competent book of some kind, but sheer human innovation results from an interaction between people who are imperfect, as opposed to AI, which has works according to an algorithm which is about as perfect as can be, and demand signals that can only be transmitted by people who are not only mind, their body as well. And so I belong to the camp that of course is cautious of these developments, but I'm not dystopian about them by any sense of the imagination. We're going to have to change the way we teach at universities. We're going to have to, I mean, a lot of mindless tasks will be removed from the table. If I spend hours and hours over statistics with my rudimentary skills, I'm sure a great algorithm will solve that issue overnight. But interpretation of the data, interaction between societies, I'm not nearly as dystopian as many people are here. It's just going to be different.
It's good to hear, but let me ask you on a very specific example here. I mean, we know now from a few years back that the algorithms on social media is sort of curating content individually for different people to sort of reinforce their worldview and to polarize. Okay, up till now, all this content has at least been produced by humans, even if it is, you know, more or less crazy people that's writing weird things. But think of a future where you have a number of ChatGPT systems that also produce the content. They produce the political speeches, the political manifestos, the deep fake videos, and so on. Quite soon, the internet will be flooded with non-human content that people won't know it's non-humans. I mean, you can be put in a situation where before you said, don't believe in everything you read on the internet, and soon you have to say, don't believe in anything you read on the internet, because it's vague. I mean, can you see a problem like that coming up?
I can, although from the little that I follow, I understand that even as there's a race to find the ultimate chat GPT among different companies, there's a similar race going on to develop tools to discern between human-generated text and artificially generated text. That's a no less important role or race that is taking place right now that people are not paying that much attention to. But those things will happen as well. Look, you remember Marshall McLuhan said that the media is the message.
The media is the message, exactly. Yeah.
And of course, there's a fear of that. Mm. I do hope, I don't believe, I hope, that this race to provide us with the tools to separate fake from real will be at least as successful as the race to produce artificial intelligence. Of course, I don't know. Mm. But yeah, it's a fear. Look, there's so many things, there's so many imponderables. I try to plan the university of the future. What professions will become redundant, for example, in the future? It's almost a futile task. I guess you can point to certain things that I learned today at the university that you know will be less important in the future. But there's so many imponderables that you just have to create a system that's flexible enough. Mm-hmm. So I'll give an example. When disciplines are dead. Mm-hmm. The future at universities will be around problems, large issues, where you'll bring in insights from various disciplines. The idea of disciplinary knowledge, which we have known for quite some time, we've said, oh, we do interdisciplinary things. For example, we take certain problems. You can take, food security, example. And we've created a hub. Mm-hmm. What does a hub mean? Let's take an example from an airport. A hub means you arrive from a certain place, and then you leave somewhere else. That's what the hub of an airplane is. And that's what a hub is going to be here, too. You're going to arrive with certain knowledge that you acquired in sociology, in biology, in history, but you're going to leave very differently because of this coalescing of disciplinary knowledge in one place. So we're going to have to prepare students for the future, give them degrees in problem solving rather than in disciplines.
Very interesting.
And we're going to have to be very flexible. I think we're going to have micro degrees. I don't know how many people are going to have patience to spend 3-4 years taking a degree. But the society will be able to handle something like this. Universities are going to go through a huge transition, and that's not simple because we're probably the most conservative people on earth, professors. Mm-hmm. Where we do things in a very conservative manner, and we're going to have to rethink that.
This makes me think about, you know, what C.P. Snow wrote about the third culture.
Yeah.
The two cultures and the third culture. It's a little bit that what you're talking about.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And what has Klaus Schwab written about the fourth industrial revolution or something like that? All this is, of course, all speculation. We don't know anything in the next generation. The next generation, by the way, it's 5 years down the road. It's not 50 years down the road.
No, true.
Generations are now, within the span of a very limited number of years. Everything changes. This is an institution that has lasted for hundreds of years, the universities.
Yeah.
And they're going to have to change or they will wither and die.
But also, I mean, I guess it's very important to create opportunities for the very fundamental research that doesn't have any practical use. I mean, like quantum physics quantum physics has a lot of practical use, but gravitational waves in astronomy, for example, there is no practical use of that at all, but they were awarded the Nobel Prize 2 years ago. How do you sort of... How do you create room for that kind of research in this scheme?
Yeah, so universities are bifurcated institutions. They prepare people for life in society. These are students, but they're also research institutions. And we should never, never, never forget the role of basic research, because almost anything that you can think of in our lives today was came out of basic research at universities.
Yeah.
And you're right, you're 100% right. We'll have to, universities have to provide space for basic research. Governments have to be patient and provide the necessary resources for universities to do this. I fear an impatience. And what I personally am trying to do is to create alliances across countries which will, I think, provide greater incentive for governments to be patient about long-term developments that we can call today basic research, which have no obvious value tomorrow for students, but are just trying to decipher the world in which we live, the fundamentals of the biological, physical, cultural world in which we live. That's going to be very difficult, as I believe both students and those who fund us will lose patience. That's why institutions like the European Research Council are so important, as they sort of detach themselves from everyday politics and provide in a very judicious manner. We are associate members of that council. Mm. In a very judicious manner, they provide funding for people who are doing research, which is basic research. Very important role of universities in the future.
Going back to the AI question, what exactly is your involvement with that? I just read somewhere that you traveled in 2017, you started some kind of AI project. Is that correct?
We have multiple.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, we have multiple AI projects. So I'll give in a couple of examples. One of them in which we work is to remove bias from AI, or to neutralize bias from AI. Gender bias, for example, is one project that we're working on right now. The other project in which we're working now in collaboration with engineering institutions, we're not an engineering institution, is the issue of ethics and AI.
Very interesting.
We bring to the table very strong understanding of philosophy and ethics.
So you have philosophy in your
Probably one of the strongest departments, if not the strongest department in the country.
Wow.
And a nearby institution, the Technion, is an engineering school, a very fine engineering school, one of the best in the world. And we've established, once again, I'll use the word hub, for understanding engineering and ethics. So the philosophers come in from one flight, the engineers come in another flight, they meet in this terminal, and hopefully they come out different people. So those are two very significant projects that we're working on right now. We're also working a lot of AI to dealing with the sea. This is, we say we live on planet Earth. We don't. We live on planet water. 70% of the surface of the globe is taken up by water. And while we pay a lot of attention to what's happening on ground, on Earth, we pay very little attention to what's happening in the sea. So I'll give you just one example. We are collaborating with a variety of institutions in the Caribbean, on the island of Dominica, where we're deciphering the communication of sperm whales. These are huge creatures which communicate with clicks, like Morse clicks. It makes it relatively easy to do. We are doing all the technology. We are placing the listening devices on the whales. MIT is doing the linguistics. Berkeley is doing the computer science and the big data. We need to understand how the creatures in the sea communicate, what they communicate, in order to manage this incredible resource for our future. We're going to be reliant on the sea in the future for protein, of course, for energy today, hopefully. Who knows what else we can extract from the sea. So that's another large project that we're doing in conjunction with other institutions. We can't do it by ourselves. You need huge data sets to decipher the language of another species. By the way, this whale project will allow us sometime in the future, will give us the theory of deciphering the language of extraterrestrials, if you would.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's a huge project funded by Ted Audacious, so it's a global project. Mm. So those are three examples of AI projects that we're doing right now.
Fantastic. Yeah. I mean, Israel in general, as I understand it, is quite strong on information technology and AI, right?
Tremendously strong. Israel is tremendously strong in these areas, tremendously innovative in these areas. I believe in this concept of small, smart countries. And I will place Sweden definitely in that group, probably Switzerland as well. And maybe Singapore would be in that group, and of course Israel. This, I would hope that in the not too distant future, that that these type of countries, which are hovering around the 10 million people, no more than that, maybe less than that, and have come up with great high-tech industries, can collaborate among themselves. They bring to the table something that the gargantuan institutions don't even care about for the most part, you know.
What do you think is the historical reason that Israel is so strong in these fields?
So the reason that Israel is so strong, there are multiple reasons. One, as you probably know, we have compulsory military service, which means that spending at least 3 years in the military. I, for example, I belonged to one of these units many years ago, and I spent 7 years in the military. And so many of the graduates of these military units, the most famous being A200, you may have heard of that name, come out with tremendous skills that that immediately feed into the civilian infrastructure. That is one reason. The other reason is a culture of learning and a culture of innovation. We live in a part of the world where you have to improvise almost on a daily basis, given the many challenges that we have where we live. And improvisation is the key to innovation. When you don't bang your head against the wall, who was it, Einstein, who said that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results? Well, we don't belong there. And we're constantly short-circuiting and innovating, even when we don't need to short-circuit. That's one of our problems. And that has something to do with it. It's also a culture of learning. If there's anything that sort of is a common denominator among Jews, is the value that they place upon education. So
That's. I mean, I've always been a great. I'm not a Jewish, but I've always been a great fan of sort of the Jewish philosophical tradition of questioning.
Always.
And I guess that might be a part of this.
It's always. We quarrel constantly. we're a very. I'm trying to find the right word here. Disputatious culture. That would be the word I would use. And I think that that's part of it. We have all sorts of sayings in Hebrew which encourage people to argue and see argument as being a positive thing, and not necessarily, we take it to extremes sometimes, but, but nevertheless, that's also a foundation of innovation, when you never accept anything as gospel, right? You're always questioning it.
Like Einstein did, for example.
That's a good example.
His whole driving force. Okay, that's very interesting. Okay, just the last question. I mean, I know you don't want to comment on the political situation, but are you optimistic? Do you think that this will turn out well? Or how do you see it?
Difficult to say, and I'll explain why. I mean, I'm not going to just say difficult to say and end this conversation. because it's not only about democracy, it's also about demography. And there are demographic changes which suggest to me that the challenge is probably more complicated than we would like to think. The birth rates in Israel among ultra-Orthodox are quite dramatic. Today, the entering class of first grade is 25% ultra-Orthodox, 25% Arab, and the more traditional population in Israel only makes up the other 50%. And the demographic, that's the one predictive science, right, is demography. And it suggests that the number of ultra-Orthodox who are not part of the workforce and do not necessarily embrace democratic values is growing. Now, to suggest that this population is static and their world will never change, I'm not going to suggest that. But it does suggest to me that the developments in the future are probably more complicated than we'd like to think. So To be very frank with you, I don't know. Mm. I really don't know, but that means I do believe that the values that we have are strong, they're robust, and we should fight for them now because it will affect the future.
Yes, let's hope for the best.
Absolutely.
Professor Ron Robbins, thank you so much for coming to our podcast.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.